with a blue-jawed paramedic leaning over him. Certain body entendres on expressions like vital signs and dilation, until the paramedic radioed ahead to Cambridge City's E room to cancel the crash cart. Manipulated his skinny arms in a parodic minimal mambo lying there. Fiddly-dee-deed, the paramedic's warning that post-seizure feelings of well-being were notoriously deceptive and transient. And then also the little-mentioned advantage to being destitute and in possession of a health card that's expired and not even in your name. Hospitals show you a kind of inverted respect. A place like Cambridge City Hospital bows to your will not to stay. They all of a sudden defer to your subjective diagnostic knowledge of your own condition, which post-seizure condition you feel has turned the corner toward improvement. They bow to your quixotic will. It's unfortunately not a free hospital, but it is a free country. They honor your wishes and compliment your mambo and say, go with God. It's a good thing you can't see what you look like, though. And the serendipity of Cambridge City Hospital being just an 8-block stroll east on Cambridge Street and then south on Prospect, through mentholated autumn air, through Inman Square and up to Antetoile Entertainment. Maybe the one last place where our renewed, post-seizure, on the diagnostic upswing of still slightly shaky, young, gender dysphoric, might yet expect a bit of kindness. Pharmacological credit, since the affairs of Wu and Copley Library and Hart. The big brick cake of the hospital behind Krauss in purple twilight. The brisk click of his heels on pavement. Boa, semi-formally loose on his shoulders and down beneath each arm, hand holding red leather collar close to the throat. Head up, and staying that way on its own. Steady eyes meeting with blasé dignity the eyes of whoever passes. The dignity of a man risen by will from the ashes of withdrawal. And now on the upswing, and with places to go, and potentially considerate Canadians to see. A charming and potentially, once again, in the not-too-distant future, gorgeous creature, with the renewed wherewithal to now meet the eyes of Inman Square pedestrians, veering sharply away from the residual smells of men's room stall and subway vomit, the ashes from which he's been rescued and risen once again, feeling righter than rain. A rind of moon hanging cocked above a four-spired church. And the emergent stars are yo-yos, you feel, after a seizure. Poor Tony feels as if he could cast them out, draw them in again at will. The way poor Tony Krauss, Lola's sister, and Susan T. Cheese became mercenary adjuncts to something dour Bertrand Antetoile had invited them to call Front Contre ONANisme was that, for a heavily cut bundle to split six ways, Lola's sister, Susan T. Cheese, P.T. Krauss, Bridget Tenderhole, Equus Reese, and the late Stokely Darkstar McNair had had to wear identical red leather coats and auburn wigs and spike heels and go and hang around the lobby of Harvard Square's Sheraton Commander Hotel with six mannish-looking women in the same wigs and coats, while an androgynous Quebecer insurgent who filled out his red leather coat in a way that made Bridget Tenderhold dig his nails into his palms in sheer green envy, came through the commander's revolving lucite doors and strode purposefully into the crowded epaulette ballroom, and threw foul, semi-liquid violet waste from a souvenir miniature waste displacement barrel in the face of the Canadian Minister of Inter-ONAN Trade, who was addressing the U.S. press from a leaf-shaped rostrum. The decoys were then required to mill hysterically in the lobby, all 12 of them, and then hit the revolving doors and disperse in a dozen different vectors as the androgynous waist-wielding Quebecer legged out of the epaulette ballroom and lobby, pursued by white-suited men with earplugs and Cobra M11 sub-automatics. So the security-guised, see-identical, epicene figures high-heeling it away in different directions and get fuddled about who to chase. Susan T. Cheese and poor Tony'd met the Antetoile brothers, only one of whom could or would speak, and who'd been in charge of the diversionary aspects of the Sheridan Commander operation, and had clearly been subordinate to still other Quebecers of way higher IQ. Krauss and STC had met them at Inman Square's Ryle's Tavern, which had gender dysphoric night every second Wednesday, and attracted comely and unrough trade, and which poor Tony passed now, Ryles, just after the Man-O-War Grill, now only a block or so from the Antitoa's glass and novelty shop front, feeling not so much quite ill again as just deeply tired after only 5 or so blocks, that post-fever, sleep-for-a-week-type cellular fatigue, and is debating with himself about whether to have a go at the purses of the 2 young and unstriking women walking just a few steps ahead, both of their purses hanging only by the flimsiest of evening-gown-width straps from slumped shoulders, the duo interracial, rare and disquieting in Metro Boston, the black girl talking a click a minute, and the white one not responding, her weary stolid plod and air of inattention fairly begging for a purse snatch, both of them with an air about them of routine victimization, the sort of demoralized lassitude poor Tony felt always guaranteed a minimum of protest or pursuit, though the white girl wore formidable-looking running shoes under her tartan skirt. So intent was poor Tony Krause on the logistics and implications of the possible purses dangled, as if, by God, right before him, how different to hit the Antitoa doorstep with liquid assets, to request a transaction rather than bare charity, more almost a social call than a contemptible, withdrawn snivel for compassion. So intent, as he sidestepped an impressive pile of dog droppings and passed across the broad windows of the Man-O-War, that he never saw his old former crewmate, Mad Matty Pemulous, a sure source of compassion, looking up and out and down and back up, aghast in recognition of what poor Tony has come through the corridor to resemble. Jeffrey Days noted the way most of the male residents of Ennett House have special little cognomens for their genitals, for example, Bruno, Jake, Fang, by Minty, the One-Eyed Monk, Fritzy, Russell, the Love Muscle. He speculates this could be a class thing. Neither he nor Ewell nor Ken or Daddy have named their units. Like Ewell, Day enters a certain amount of comparative class data in his journal. Dooney Glynn called his penis Poor Richard. Chandler Foss confessed to the moniker Bam Bam. Lance had referred to his own unit as the Frightful Hog. Day would die before admitting he missed either Lance or his soliloquies about the hog, which had been frequent. The penis in question had been that curious 2 or 3 shades darker than the rest of Lance that people's penises sometimes are. Lance had brandished it at his roommates whenever he wished to emphasize a point. It had been short and thick and blunt. And Lentz described the hog as a primo example of what he called the Polish curse. Namely, undistinguished length, but sobering circumference. Easy on the bottom, but tears hell out of the sides, brother. This had been his description of the Polish curse. A surprising amount of Day's recovery journal is filled with quotations from R. Lentz. Lentz's discharge had moved the tax attorney, Tiny Ewell, up into the 3-man room with Day. Ewell was the one man here with whom a conversation of anything remotely approaching depth could be held. So Day was nonplussed when he found himself, after a couple long nights, almost missing Lentz, his obsession with time, his patter, his way of leaning up against the wall upside down in his briefs, or brandishing the hog. And with regard to Ennett House resident Kate Gompert and this depression issue, some psychiatric patients, plus a certain percentage of people who've gotten so dependent on chemicals for feelings of well-being that when the chemicals have to be abandoned, they undergo a loss trauma that reaches way down deep into the soul's core systems, these persons know firsthand that there's more than one kind of so-called depression. One kind is low-grade and sometimes gets called anhedonia.
280.
Or simple melancholy. It's a kind of spiritual torpor in which one loses the ability to feel pleasure or attachment to things formerly important. The avid bowler drops out of his league and stays home at night staring dully at kickboxing cartridges. The gourmand is off his feed. The sensualist finds his beloved unit all of a sudden to be so much feelingless gristle. just hanging there. The devoted wife and mother finds the thought of her family about as moving all of a sudden as a theorem of Euclid. It's a kind of emotional novocaine, this form of depression. And while it's not overtly painful, its deadness is disconcerting and, well, depressing. Kate Gompertz always thought of this anhedonic state as a kind of radical abstracting of everything, a hollowing out of stuff that used to have effective content, terms the undepressed toss around and take for granted as full and fleshy, happiness, joie de vivre, preference, love, are stripped of their skeletons and reduced to abstract ideas. They have, as it were, denotation, but not connotation. The anhedonic can still speak about happiness and meaning and others, but she has become incapable of feeling anything in them, of understanding anything about them, of hoping anything about them, or of believing them to exist as anything more than concepts. Everything becomes an outline of the thing. Objects become schemata. The world becomes a map of the world. An anhedonic can navigate, but has no location. That is, the anhedonic becomes, in the lingo of Boston AA, unable to identify. It's worth noting that among younger ETAs, the standard take on Dr. J.O.N. Condenza's suicide attributes his putting his head in the microwave to this kind of anhedonia. This is maybe because anhedonia is often associated with the crises that afflict extremely goal-oriented people who reach a certain age having achieved all or more than all than they'd hoped for. The what-does-it-all-mean type crisis of middle-aged Americans. In fact, this is, in fact, not what killed in Condenza at all. In fact, the presumption that he'd achieved all his goals and found that the achievement didn't confer meaning or joy on his existence says more about the students at ETA than it says about Oren's and Hal's father. Still under the influence of the DeLint-like carrot-and-stick philosophies of their hometown coaches, rather than the more paradoxical shtit in Condenza Lyle School, younger athletes who can't help gauging their whole worth by their place in an ordinal ranking use the idea that achieving their goals and finding the gnawing sense of worthlessness still there in their own gut as a kind of psychic bogey, something that they can use to justify stopping on their way down to dawn drills to smell the flowers along the ETA paths. The idea that achievement doesn't automatically confer interior worth is to them still, at this age, an abstraction, rather like the prospect of their own death. Caius is mortal, and so on. Deep down, they all still view the competitive carrot as the grail. They're mostly going through the motions when they invoke anhedonia. They're mostly small children, keep in mind. Listen to any sort of sub-16 exchange you hear in the bathroom or food line. Hey there, how are you? Number 8 this week is how I am. They all still worship the carrot. With the possible exception of the tormented Lamont Chu, they all, still, subscribe to the delusive idea that the continent's second-ranked 14-year-old feels exactly twice as worthwhile as the continent's number 4. Deluded or not, it's still a lucky way to live, even though it's temporary. It may well be that the lower-ranked little kids at ETA are proportionally happier than the higher-ranked kids, since we, who are mostly not small children, know it's more invigorating to want than to have, it seems. Though maybe this is just the inverse of the same delusion. Hal and Condenza, though he has no idea yet of why his father really put his head in a specially dickied microwave in the year of the trial-sized Dove Bar, is pretty sure that it wasn't because of standard U.S. anhedonia. Hal himself hasn't had a bona fide intensity of interior life type emotion since he was tiny. He finds terms like joie and value to be like so many variables in rarefied equations, and he can manipulate them well enough to satisfy everyone but himself that he's in there, inside his own hull as a human being. But in fact, he's far more robotic than John Wayne. One of his troubles with his mom's is the fact that Averill Incandenza believes she knows him inside and out as a human being, and an internally worthy one at that, when in fact, inside Hal, there's pretty much nothing at all, he knows. His mom's Averill hears her own echoes inside him and thinks what she hears is him, and this makes Hal feel the one thing he feels to the limit lately. He is lonely. It's of some interest that the lively arts of the millennial USA treat anhedonia and internal emptiness as hip and cool. It's maybe the vestiges of the romantic glorification of Weltschmerz, which means world weariness, or hip ennui. Maybe it's the fact that most of the arts here are produced by world-weary and sophisticated older people, and then consumed by younger people who not only consume art but study it for clues on how to be cool, hip. And keep in mind that, for kids and younger people, to be hip and cool is the same as to be admired and accepted and included, and so, unalone. Forget so-called peer pressure. It's more like peer hunger. No? We enter a spiritual puberty where we snap to the fact that the great transcendent horror is loneliness, excluded encagement in the self. Once we've hit this age, we will now give or take anything, wear any mask, to fit, be part of, not be alone, we young. The U.S. arts are our guide to inclusion, a how-to. We are shown how to fashion masks of ennui and jaded irony at a young age where the face is fictile enough to assume the shape of whatever it wears. And then, it's stuck there. The weary cynicism that saves us from gooey sentiment and unsophisticated naivete. Sentiment equals naivete on this continent, at least since the reconfiguration. One of the things sophisticated viewers have always liked about J.O. Incandenza's The American Century as Seen Through a Brick is its unsubtle thesis that naivete is the last true terrible sin in the theology of millennial America. And since sin is the sort of thing that can be talked about only figuratively, it's natural that himself's dark little cartridge was mostly about a myth, namely, that queerly persistent U.S. myth that cynicism and naivete are mutually exclusive. Hal, who's empty but not dumb, theorizes privately that what passes for hip, cynical transcendence of sentiment is really some kind of fear of being really human, since to be really human, at least as he conceptualizes it, is probably to be unavoidably sentimental and naive and goo-prone and generally pathetic, is to be in some basic interior way forever infantile, some sort of not-quite-right-looking infant dragging itself anaclitically around the map, with big wet eyes and froggy soft skin, huge skull, gooey drool. One of the really American things about Hal, probably, is the way he despises what it is he's really lonely for. This hideous internal self, incontinent of sentiment and need, that pules and writhes just under the hip empty mask. Anhedonia.
281.
The American Century as Seen Through a Brick's main and famous key image is of a piano string vibrating. A high D, it looks like, vibrating, and making a very sweet, unadorned solo sound indeed. And then a little thumb comes into the frame, a blunt, moist, pale, and yet dingy thumb, with disreputable stuff crusted in one of the nail corners, small and unlined, clearly an infantile thumb. And as it touches the piano string, the high, sweet sound immediately dies, and the silence that follows is excruciating. Later in the film, after much mordant and didactic panoramic brick following, we're back at the piano string and the thumb is removed, and the high, sweet sound recommences, extremely pure and solo. And yet now somehow, as the volume increases, now with something rotten about it underneath, there's something sick sweet and overripe and potentially putrid about the one clear high D. As its volume increases and increases, the sound getting purer and louder and more dysphoric until, After a surprisingly few seconds, we find ourselves right in the middle of the pure, undampered sound, longing, and even maybe praying for the return of the natal thumb to shut it up. Hal isn't old enough yet to know that this is because numb emptiness isn't the worst kind of depression. That dead-eyed anhedonia is but a remora on the ventral flank of the true predator, the great white shark of pain. Authorities term this condition clinical depression, or involutional depression, or unipolar dysphoria. Instead of just an incapacity for feeling, a deadening of soul, the predator-grade depression Kate Gompert always feels as she withdraws from secret marijuana is itself a feeling. It goes by many names. Anguish, despair, torment, or which see Burton's melancholia, or Yevtushenko's more authoritative psychotic depression. But Kate Gompert, down in the trenches with the thing itself, knows it simply as it. It is a level of psychic pain wholly incompatible with human life as we know it. It is a sense of radical and thoroughgoing evil, not just as a feature, but as the essence of conscious existence. It is a sense of poisoning that pervades the self at the self's most elementary levels. It is a nausea of the cells and soul. It is an unnumb intuition in which the world is fully rich and animate and unmap-like and also thoroughly painful and malignant and antagonistic to the self. Which depressed self it billows on and coagulates around and wraps in its black folds and absorbs into itself, so that an almost mystical unity is achieved in a world where every constituent of which means painful harm to the self. Its emotional character, the feeling Gompert describes it as, is probably most indescribable except as a sort of double bind, in which any/all of the alternatives we associate with human agency, sitting or standing, doing or resting, speaking or keeping silent, living or dying, are not just unpleasant, but literally horrible. It is also lonely, on a level that cannot be conveyed. There is no way Kate Gompert could ever even begin to make someone else understand what clinical depression feels like. Not even another person who is herself clinically depressed, because a person in such a state is incapable of empathy with any other living thing. This anhedonic inability to identify is also an integral part of it. If a person in physical pain has a hard time attending to anything except that pain,
282.
A clinically depressed person cannot even perceive any other person or thing as independent of the universal pain that is digesting her cell by cell. Everything is part of the problem, and there is no solution. It is a hell for one. The authoritative term psychotic depression makes Kate Gompert feel especially lonely, specifically the psychotic part. Think of it this way. Two people are screaming in pain. One of them is being tortured with electric current. The other is not. The screamer who's being tortured with electric current is not psychotic. Her screams are circumstantially appropriate. The screaming person who is not being tortured, however, is psychotic, since the outside parties making the diagnoses can see no electrodes or measurable amperage. One of the least pleasant things about being psychotically depressed, on a ward full of psychotically depressed patients, is coming to see that none of them is really psychotic. That their screams are entirely appropriate to certain circumstances, part of whose special charm is that they are undetectable by any outside party. Thus, the loneliness. It's a closed circuit. The current is both applied and received from within. The so-called psychotically depressed person who tries to kill herself doesn't do so out of, quote, hopelessness or any abstract conviction that life's assets and debits do not square, and surely not because death seems suddenly appealing. The person in whom its invisible agony reaches a certain unendurable level will kill herself the same way A trapped person will eventually jump from the window of a burning high-rise. Make no mistake about people who leap from burning windows. Their terror of falling from a great height is still just as great as it would be for you or me standing speculatively at the same window just checking out the view. That is, the fear of falling remains a constant. The variable here is the other terror, the fire's flames. When the flames get close enough, falling to death becomes the slightly less terrible of two terrors. It's not desiring the fall, it's terror of the flames. And yet nobody down on the sidewalk looking up and yelling, "Don't!" and "Hang on!" can understand the jump. Not really. You'd have to have personally been trapped and felt flames to really understand a terror way beyond falling. But, and so, the idea of a person in the grip of it being bound by a suicide contract, some well-meaning substance abuse halfway house makes her sign, is simply absurd. Because such a contract will constrain such a person only until the exact psychic circumstances that made the contract necessary in the first place assert themselves, invisibly and indescribably. That the well-meaning halfway house staff does not understand its overriding terror will only make the depressed resident feel more alone. One fellow psychotically depressed patient Kate Gompert came to know at Newton Wellesley Hospital in Newton 2 years ago was a man in his 50s. He was a civil engineer whose hobby was model trains, like from Lionel Trains, Inc., etc., for which he erected incredibly intricate systems of switching and track that filled his basement recreation room. His wife brought photographs of the trains and networks of trellis and track into the locked ward to help remind him. The man said he had been suffering from psychotic depression for 17 straight years, and Kate Gompert had had no reason to disbelieve him. He was stocky and swart with thinning hair and hands that he held very still in his lap as he sat. 20 years ago, he had slipped on a patch of 3-in-1 brand oil from his model train tracks and bonked his head on the cement floor of his basement rec room in Wellesley Hills, and when he woke up in the ER, he was depressed beyond all human endurance and stayed that way. He'd never once tried suicide, though he confessed that he yearned for unconsciousness without end. His wife was very devoted and loving. She went to Catholic Mass every day. She was very devout. The psychotically depressed man, too, went to daily Mass when he was not institutionalized. He prayed for relief. He still had his job and his hobby. He went to work regularly, taking medical leaves only when the invisible torment got too bad for him to trust himself, or when there was some radical new treatment the psychiatrists wanted him to try. They tried tricyclics, MAOIs, insulin comas, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors,
283,
the new and side-effect-laden quadricyclics. They'd scanned his lobes and effective matrices for lesions and scars. Nothing worked. Not even high amperage ECT relieved it. This happens sometimes. Some cases of depression are beyond human aid. The man's case gave Kate Gompert the howling phantods. The idea of this man going to work and to Mass and building miniaturized railroad networks day after day after day, while feeling anything like what Kate Gompert felt in that ward, was simply beyond her ability to imagine. The rational-spiritual part of her knew this man and his wife must be possessed of a courage way off any sort of known courage chart. But in her toxified soul, Kate Gompert felt only a paralyzing horror at the idea of the squat, dead-eyed man laying toy track slowly and carefully in the silence of his wood-paneled rec room. The silence total, except for the sounds of the track being oiled and snapped together and laid into place, the man's head full of poison and worms, and every cell in his body screaming for relief from flames no one else could help with or even feel. The permanently psychotically depressed man was finally transferred to a place on Long Island to be evaluated for a radical new type of psychosurgery where they supposedly went in and yanked out your whole limbic system, which is the part of the brain that causes all sentiment and feeling. The man's fondest dream was anhedonia, complete psychic numbing, that is, death in life. The prospect of radical psychosurgery was the dangled carrot, but Kate guessed still gave the man's life enough meaning for him to hang onto the windowsill by his fingernails, which were probably black and gnarled from the flames. That and his wife. He seemed genuinely to love his wife, and she, him. He went to bed every night at home holding her, weeping for it to be over, while she prayed, or did that devout thing with beads. The couple had gotten Kate Gompert's mother's address and had sent Kate an Xmas card the last 2 years, Mr. and Mrs. Ernest Feaster, of Wellesley Hills, Massachusetts, stating that she was in their prayers and wishing her all available joy. Kate Gompert doesn't know whether Mr. Ernest Feaster's limbic system got yanked out or not, whether he achieved anhedonia. The Xmas cards had excruciating little watercolor pictures of locomotives on them. She could barely stand to think about them, even at the best of times, which the present was not. The 14th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Ms. Ruth Van Cleves, first day off new residence, 3-day house restriction. Allowed now to hit meetings outside Enfield, if accompanied by some more senior resident the staff judges safe. Ruth Van Cleve and Spike Heels, walking alongside a psychotically depressed Kate Gompert on Prospect just south of Inman Square, Cambridge, a little after 2200 hours, yammering nonstop. Ruth Van Cleve is shaping up to be excruciating for Kate Gompert to be around. Ruth Van Cleve hails from Braintree on the South Shore, is many kilos underweight, wears brass-colored lipstick, and has dry hair teased out in the big hair fashion of decades past. Her face has the late-stage ice addict's concave, long-jawed, insectile look.
284.
Her hair is a dry, tangled cloud with tiny little eyes and bones and projecting beak underneath. Joelle V. Deed said it almost looked like Ruth Van Cleve's hair grew her head instead of the other way around. Kate Gompert's hair is butcher block cut, and has recognizable color at least. Kate Gompert hasn't slept in 4 nights, and her slumped progress up the Prospect sidewalk resembles the lazy tack of a boat in no rush. Ruth Van Cleve talks nonstop into her right ear. It's around 2200 hours on Saturday, and the sodium street lights keep going off and then on again with a stuttered hum, some connection in them loose somewhere. Foot traffic is dense, and the undead and drunks who live in the streets around Inman Square also crowd the sidewalk's edges. And if KG looks at the images of passers-by in the darkened shop windows, they become, pedestrians and undead STEM artists, just heads that seem to float across each window unconnected to anything. As in disconnected, floating heads. In doorways by shops are incomplete persons in wheelchairs with creative receptacles where limbs should be, and hand-lettered invitations to help them. An oral narrative begins to emerge. Ms. Ruth V.C. has been remanded to Ennett House by DSS and Family Court after her newborn baby was discovered in a Braintree, Massachusetts alley, swaddled in Walmart advertising circulars, whose Harvest Moon value specials had expired 11:01, a Sunday. Ruth Van Cleve had rather unshrewdly left the hospital ID bracelet with its DOB and her own name and health card number on the discarded infant's wrist. The infant is apparently now in a South Shore hospital incubator, attached to machines and tapering off the clonidine.
285.
It received for in-utero addictions to substances Kate Gompert can only speculate about.
286.
The father of Ruth Van Cleve's child, she reports, is under the protection and care of the Norfolk County Correctional Authority, awaiting sentencing for what Ruth Van Cleve described several times as operating a pharmaceutical company without a license. What's remarkable to Kate Gompert is that she seems to be able to move forward without any sort of conscious moving forward type volitions. She puts her left foot in front of her right foot, and then her right foot in front of her left foot, and she's moving forward, her whole self, when all she's capable of concentrating on is one foot and then the other foot. Heads glide by in the darkened windows. Some of the Latino males in the vicinity do a kind of sexual checking out as they pass, even though underweight and dry-haired and kind of haggish. Ruth Van Cleve's manner and attire and big hair broadcast that she's all about sexuality and sex. A negative thing about opting for recovery in NA instead of AA is availability and location of meetings. In other words, fewer NA meetings. On a Saturday night, you could stand on the roof of Ennett House in Enfield and be hard-pressed to spit in any direction without hitting some AA venue nearby. Whereas the closest Saturday PM NA meeting is North Cambridge's Clean and Serene group, infamous for crosstalk and chair-throwing, and the thing's beginner's meeting goes from 2,000 to 2,100 hours, and the regular from 2,100 to 2,200 hours. Purposely late, to offset the Saturday night Joneses so many drug addicts suffer weekly, Saturday still being the week's special, mythic, party night, even for persons who long ago ceased to be able to do anything but party 24/7/365. But from Inman Square back to Ennett House is a ghastly hike. Hoof up Prospect to Central Square, and take the Red Line all the way to Park Street Station, and then the maddening Green Line B train forever west on Comm Ave. And it's now after 22:15 hours, meaning Kate Gompert has 75 minutes to get herself and this hideous, despair-producing, slutty, and yammering newcomer beside her back for curfew. Ruth Van Cleve's chatter is as listener-interest-independent as anything Kate Gompert's heard since Randy Lance got invited to ingest substances and abuse animals elsewhere. And left, which was who knows how many days or weeks ago. The two move in and out of cones of epileptic light from fluttering street lamps. Kate Gompert is trying not to shudder as Ruth Van Cleve asks her if she knows some place you can pick up a good toothbrush cheap. Kate Gompert's entire spiritual energy and attention are focused on first her left foot and then her right foot. One of the heads she does not see, floating in the windows with her own unrecognizable head, and Ruth Van Cleve's cloud of hair, is the gaunt and spectral hollow-eyed head of poor Tony Krause, who's several steps behind them, and matching their slightly serpentine course step for step, eyeing string purses he imagines contain more than just train fare and N.A. newcomers' keychains. The vaporizer chugs and seethes and makes the room's windows weep, as Jim Trolch inserts a pro wrestling cartridge in the little TP's viewer and dons his tackiest sport coat and wet combs his hair down smooth so it looks toupee-ish, and settles back on his bunk, surrounded by Celdane bottles and two-ply facial tissue, preparing to call the action. His roommates have long since seen what was coming, and screwed. Standing on tiptoe in Subdorm B's curved hallway, using the handle of an inverted tennis racket whose vinyl cover he can absently zip and unzip as he moves the handle around, Michael Pemulis is gently raising one of the panels in the drop ceiling and shifting it on its aluminum strut, the panel, changing its lie on the strut from square-shaped to diamond-shaped, being careful not to let it fall. Lyle hovers cross-legged just a couple millimeters above the top of the towel dispenser in the unlit weight room, eyes rolled up white, lips barely moving, and making no sound. Coach Stitt and Mario tear ass downhill on West Commonwealth on Stitt's old BMW, bound for Evangeline's low-temperature confections in Newton Center, right at the bottom of what usually gets called Heartbreak Hill. Stitt, intense-faced and leaning forward like a skier, his white scarf whipping around and whipping Mario's face in the sidecar, as Mario, too, leans way forward into their downhill flight, preparing to whoop when they bottom out. Ms. Avril Incandenza, seeming somehow to have three or four cigarettes all going at once, secures from information the phone and email numbers of a journalistic business address on East Tucson, Arizona's Blasted Expanse Boulevard, then begins to dial, using the stern of a blue felt pen to stab at the console's keys.
Aye!
Cries the man, rushing at the nun, wielding a power tool. The tough-looking nun yells,
Aye!
Right back as she kicks him expertly, her habit's skirts whipping complexly around her. The combatants circle each other warily in the abandoned warehouse, both growling. The nun's wimple is askew and soiled. The back of her hand, held out in a bladish martial art fist, displays part of a faded tattoo, some wicked clawed bird of prey. The cartridge opens like this, in violent medias res, then freezes in the middle of the nun's leaping kick and its title, Blood Sister, One Tough Nun, gets matte dissolved in, and bleeds lurid, blood-colored light down into the performance credits rolling across the screen's bottom. Bridget Boone and Francis L. Unwin have come in uninvited and joined Hal in VR6 and are curled up against the arms of the room's other recumbency, their feet touching at the soles. Boone eating unauthorized frozen yogurt from a cylindrical carton. Hal's turned the rheostat down low, and the film's title and credits make their faces glow redly. Bridget Boone extends the confection carton over in Hal's direction in an inviting way, and by way of declining, Hal points to the lump of Kodiak in his cheek and makes a display of leaning out to spit. He appears to be studying the scrolling credits very closely. "So what is this?" Fran Unwin says. Hal looks over at her very slowly. Then even more slowly, raises his right arm and points around the tennis ball he's squeezing at the monitor, where the cartridge's 50-point title is still trickling redly over the credits and frozen scene. Bridget Boone gives him a look.
"What's up your particular butt?"
"I'm isolating. I came in here to be by myself." She has this way that gets to Hal of digging the chocolate yogurt out with a spoon, and then inverting the spoon, turning the spoon over, so that it always enters her mouth upside down, and her tongue gets to contact the confection immediately, without the mediation of cold spoon. And for some reason, this has always gotten under Hal's skin.
"So then you should have locked the door."
"Except there aren't locks on the VR doors, as you quite well know."
287.
Round-faced, Franny Unwin says, "Shh." Then, too, sometimes Boone plays with the laden spoon, makes it fly around in front of her face like a child's plane before inverting it and sticking it in.
"Maybe this is partly because this is a public room for everybody that your thinking person probably wouldn't choose to isolate in."
Hal leans over to spit and lets the spit hang for a while before he lets it go, so it hangs there slowly distending. Boone withdraws the clean spoon just as slowly.
"No matter how sullen and pouty that person is over that person's play, or near loss in full view of a whole crowd that day, I hear."
"Bridget, I forgot to tell you. I saw that Rite Aid's having an enormous clearance on emetics. If I were you, I'd scoot right over."
"You are vile."
Bernadette Longley sticks her long, boxy head in the door and sees Bridget Boone and says,
"I thought I heard you in here,"
and comes in uninvited with Jenny Bash in tow. Hal whimpers. Jenny Bash looks at the large screen. The cartridge's theme music is female choral and very heavy and ironic on the descants. Bernadette Longley looks at Hal.
"You know there's a totally huge lady cruising the halls looking for you, with a notebook and a very determined expression."
Boone banks the spoon back and forth absently.
"He's isolating. He won't respond, and is spitting extra repulsively to get across the point." Jenny Bash says, "Haven't you got a huge paper due for Teary tomorrow? There was moaning coming from Struck and Shaw's room."
Hal packs chew down with his tongue. "Done."
"Figures,"
Bridget Boone says. "Done, redone, formatted, printed, proofed, collated, stapled."
"Proof to within its life," Boone says, barrel rolling the spoon.
Hal can tell she's done a couple one-hitters. He's looking straight at the wall screen, squeezing the ball so hard his forearm keeps swelling to twice its size.
"Plus, I hear your best friend in the whole world did something really funny today,"
Longley says.
"She means Pemulous,"
Fran Unwin tells Hal.
Bridget Boone makes dive bomber sounds and swoops the spoon around. Sounds like too good a story not to save, and let my craving for it build and build until finally it's like I have to hear it or die right on the spot.
What is up his butt? Jenny Bash asks Fran Unwin.
Fran Unwin's a sort of Hanuman-faced girl, with a torso and trunk about twice as long as her legs, and a scuttly, vaguely simian style of play. Bernadette Longley wears knee-length candy cane trousers and a sweatshirt with the fleecy inside out. All the girls are now in socks. Hal notes that girls always seem to slip out of their shoes when they assume any kind of spectatorial posture. Eight empty, white sneakers now sit mute and weird at various points, slightly sunk in carpet pile. No two of the shoes face quite the same exact direction. Male players, on the other hand, tend to leave the footwear on when they come in and sit down somewhere. Girls literally embody the idea of making yourself at home. Males, when they come in somewhere and sit down, project an air of transience. Remain suited up and mobile. It's the same whenever Hal comes in and sits down someplace where people are already gathered. He's aware that they sense he's somehow there only in a very technical sense, that he's got an air of moments-notice readiness to leave about him. Boone extends her carton of TCBY toward Longley in an inviting way, even tilting it, invitingly, back and forth.
288.
Longley puffs her cheeks and blows air out with a fatigued sound. At least three different smells of cologne and skin cream struggle for primacy in here. Bridget Boone's free L.A. Gear shoes are both on their sides from the force of having been almost kicked off her feet. Hal's spit makes a sound against the bottom of the wastebasket. Jenny Bash has bigger arms than Hal. The viewing room is redly dim. Bash asks Unwin what they're watching. Blood Sister, One Tough Nun, one of himself's few commercial successes, wouldn't have made near the money it made if it hadn't come out just as Interlace was starting to purchase first-run features for its rental menus and hyping the cartridges with one-time, spontaneous disseminations. It was the sort of sleazy-looking shock-sploitation film that would have had a two-week run in multiplex theaters, 8 and above, and then gone right to the featureless brown boxes of magnetic video limbo. Hal's critical take on the film is that himself, at certain dark points, when abstract theory issues seem to provide an escape from the far more wrenching creative work of making humanly true or entertaining cartridges, had made films in certain commercial-type genre modes that so grotesquely exaggerated the formulaic shticks of the genres that they became ironic meta-cinematic parodies on the genres. Sub-slash-inversions of the genres, cognoscenti taken in, we're wont to call them. The meta-cinematic parody idea itself was aloof and over-clever to Hal's way of thinking, and he's not comfortable with the way himself always seemed to get seduced by the very commercial formulae he was trying to invert, especially the seductive formulae of violent payback, that is, the cathartic bloodbath. That is, the hero trying with every will fiber to eschew the generic world of the stick and fist, and but driven by unjust circumstance back to the violence again, to the cathartic final bloodbath the audience is brought to applaud instead of mourn. Himself's best in this vein was The Night Wears a Sombrero, a Lang-esque meta-western, but also a really good western, with chintzy homemade interior sets but breathtaking exterior shot outside Tucson, Arizona. An ambivalent but finally avenging sun story played out against dust-colored skies and big angles of flesh-colored mountain, plus with minimal splatter, shot men clutching their chests and falling deliciously sideways, all hats staying on at all times. Blood Sister, One Tough Nun, was a supposedly ironic lampoon of the avenging cleric splatter films of the late B.S. 90s. Nor did himself make any friends on either side of the concavity, trying to shoot the thing in Canada. Hal tries to imagine the tall, slumped, tremulous stork shape of himself, inclined at an osteoporotic angle over digital editing equipment for hours on end, deleting and inserting code, arranging Blood Sister One Tough Nun into subversive slash inversion, and can't summon one shadowy idea of what himself might have been feeling as he patiently labored. Maybe that was the point of the thing's meta-silliness, to have nothing really felt going on.
289.
Jenny Bash has left VR6's door agape, and Idris, Arslanian, and Todd Postlethwaite, and Kent Blott all drift in and sit Indian-style in a loose hemisphere on the thick carpet between the girls' recumbency and Hal's recumbency, and are more or less considerately quiet. They all keep their sneakers on. Postlethwaite's nose is a massive, proboscoid, bandaged thing. Kent Blott wears a sports fisherman's cap with an extremely long bill. That queer, faint smell of hot dogs that seems to follow Idris Arslanian around begins to insinuate itself into the room's colognes. He isn't wearing the rayon handkerchief as a blindfold, but does have it tied around his neck. No one asks him about it. While the littler kids are consummate spectators and are sucked immediately into Blood Sister's unfolding narrative, and the older females seem to take some kind of psychic cue from the little boys and subside, too, and watch. Until after a while, Hal's the only person in the room who isn't 100% absorbed. The entertainment's uptake is that a tough biker chick-type girl from the mean streets of Toronto is found OD'd, beaten up, molested, and robbed of her leather jacket outside the portcullis of a downtown convent, and is rescued, nursed, befriended, spiritually guided and converted, saved, is the weak entendre made much of in the first act's dialogue, by a tough-looking older nun who, it turns out, she reveals, the tough older nun, had herself been hauled up out of a life of Harleys, narcotics dealing and addiction, by an even tougher, even older nun, a nun who had herself been saved by a tough ex-biker nun, and so on. The last saved biker chick becomes a tough and street-smart nun in the same urban order, and is known on the mean streets as Blood Sister. And Wimple or not, still rides her hog from parish to parish, and still knows Aikido, and is not to be fucked with, is the word on the streets. The motivational crux here being that almost this whole order of nuns is staffed by nuns who'd been saved from Toronto's mean, dead-end streets by other older, tougher, saved nuns. So, endless novenas later, Blood Sister eventually feels this transitive spiritual urge to go out and find a troubled adolescent female of her own to save and bring into the order, thereby discharging her soul's debt to the old tough nun who'd saved her. Through processes obscure, a Toronto troubled but savable adolescent girl directory of some sort, Bridget Boone cuts wise, Blood Sister eventually takes on a burn-scarred, deeply troubled adolescent punker-type Toronto girl who is sullen and, yes, reasonably tough, but is also vulnerable and emotionally tormented. The girl's pink, shiny, burn-scarred face tends to writhe in misery whenever she thinks Blood Sister's not looking, by the terrible depredation she's endured as a result of her rapacious and unshakable addiction to crank cocaine, the kind you have to convert and cook up yourself, and with ether, which is highly combustible, and which people used before somebody found out baking soda and temperature flux would do the same thing, which dates the film's BS time period even more clearly than the tough, tortured punk girl's violet, stelliform coiffure.
290.
But, so, Blood Sister eventually gets the girl clean by nurturing her through withdrawal in a locked sacristy, and the girl becomes less sullen by degrees that almost have audible clicks to them. The girl stops trying to dicky the lock of the sacramental wine cabinet. Stops farting on purpose during matins and vespers. Stops going up to the Trappists who hang around the convent and asking them for the time, and other sly little things to try to make them slip up and speak aloud, etc. A couple times the girl's face writhes in emotional torment and vulnerability even when Blood Sister's looking. The girl gets a severe and somewhat lesbianic haircut, and her roots establish themselves as softly brown. Blood Sister, revealing biceps like nobody's business, beats the girl at arm wrestling. They both laugh. They compare tattoos. This marks the start of a brutally drawn-out getting-to-know-and-trust-you montage, a genre convention, this montage involving Harley rides at such speeds that the girl has to keep her hand on Blood Sister's head to keep B.S.'s wimple from flying off, and long conversational walks filmed at wide angle, and protracted and basically unwinnable games of charades with the Trappists, plus some quick scenes of Blood Sister finding the girl's Marlboros and dildo facsimile lighter in the wastebasket, of the girl doing chores unsullenly under B.S.'s grudgingly approving eye, of candlelit scripture study sessions with the girl's finger under each word she reads, of the girl carefully snipping the last bits of split violet ends from her soft brown hair, of the more senior tough nuns punching Blood Sister's shoulder approvingly as the girl's eyes start to get that impending conversion gleam in them. Then, finally, a Blood Sister and the girl habit shopping, the girl's burned lantern jaw and hairless Promethean brow frozen in a sunlit montage climax shot under a novitiate Wimple's gull wings, all accompanied by, no kidding, getting to know you, which Hal imagines the stork justified to himself as subversively saccharine. This all takes about half an hour. Bridget Boone of the Indianapolis Archdiocese begins to declaim briefly on Blood Sister One Tough Nun's ironic anti-Catholic subthesis, that the deformed addicted girl's salvation here seemed simply the exchange of one will-obliterating habit for another, substituting one sort of outlandish head decoration for another, and gets pinched by Jenny Bash and shushed by just about everyone in the room but Hal, who could pass for sleep except for the brief lists to port over the wastebasket to spit, and in fact is experiencing some of the radical loss of concentration that attends THC withdrawal, and is thinking about another, even more familiar J.O. Incandenza cartridge, even while he watches this one with the other ETAs. This other attention object is the late himself's so-called inversion of the corporate politics genre, low-temperature civics. An executive suite soap opera filled with power plays, position jockeyings, timid adulteries, martinis, and malignantly pretty female executives in elegant, tight-fitting dress-for-success wear who eat their paunched and muddled male counterparts for political lunch. Hal knows that low-temperature civics wasn't an inversion or lampoon at all, but derived right from the dark B.S. 80s period when himself had changed careers from government service to private entrepreneurism, when a sudden infusion of patent receipts left him feeling post-carrot anhedonic and existentially unmoored, and himself took an entire year off to drink wild turkey and watch broadcast television tycoon operas like Lorimar's Dynasty and others in a remote spa off Canada's northwest coast, where he supposedly met and bonded with Lyle, now of the ETA weight room. What's intriguing, but unknown to everyone in VR6, is the way Boone's take on himself's take of the substitution of one crutch for another interpretation of substituting Catholic devotion for chemical dependence is very close to the way many, not yet desperate enough newcomers to Boston AA, see Boston AA as just an exchange of slavish dependence on the bottle slash pipe for slavish dependence on meetings and banal shibboleths and robotic piety, an attitude of platitude, and use this idea that it's still slavish dependence as an excuse to stop trying Boston AA and to go back to the original slavish substance dependence, until that dependence has finally beaten them into such a double-bound desperation that they finally come back in with their faces hanging off their skulls and beg to be told just what platitudes to shout and how high to adjust their vacant grins. Some substance-dependent persons, though, have already been so broken by the time they first come in that they don't care about stuff like substitution or banality. They'll give their left nut to trade their original dependence in for robotic platitudes and pep rally cheer. They're the ones with the gun to their head, the ones who stick and hang. It remains to be determined whether Joel Van Dyne, whose first appearance in a James O. Incandenza project occurred in this very low-temperature civics, Is one of these people who've come into AA/NA shattered enough to stick? But she's starting to ID more and more with the commitment speakers she hears, who did come in shattered enough to know it's get straight or die. A click and a half straight downhill from ETA, Joelle is hitting the reality is for people that can't handle drugs group, a meeting of the NA Splinter Cocaine Anonymous.
291.
Mostly because the meeting's in the St. Elizabeth's Hospital Grand Rounds Auditorium, just a couple floors down from where Don Gately, whom she just got done visiting and mopping the massive unconscious forehead of, is lying in the trauma wing in a truly bad way. Cocaine Anonymous meetings have a long preamble and endless little Xeroxed formalities they read aloud at the start, is one reason Joelle avoids CA, but the opening stuff is done by the time she gets down and comes in and gets some burnt, urn-bottom coffee and finds an available seat. The only empty seats are in the meeting's back row. Denial aisle, the back rows are usually called. And Joelle is surrounded by cachexic newcomers crossing and uncrossing their legs every few seconds and sniffing compulsively and looking like they're wearing everything they own. Plus, there's the row of standing men. There's a certain hard-faced type of male in Boston fellowships who refuses ever to sit for meetings. Standing behind the back row, legs set wide and arms crossed, and talking to each other out of the sides of their mouths. And she can tell the standing men are looking at her bare knees over her shoulder, making little comments about the knees and the veil. She thinks, with fearful sentiment of Don Gately.
292.
A tube down his throat, torn by fever and guilt and shoulder pain, offered Demerol by well-meaning but clueless MDs, in and out of delirium, torn, convinced that certain men with hats wished him ill, looking at his room's semi-private ceiling like it would eat him if he dropped his guard. The big blackboard up on the stage says, "The reality is for people that can't handle drugs group welcomes tonight's commitment speakers, the freeway access group from Mattapan," which is deep in the colored part of Boston where Cocaine Anonymous tends to be most heavily concentrated. The speaker just starting in at the podium when Joelle sits down is a tall, yellowish-colored man with a weightlifter's build and frightening eyes, slow and a kind of tan and brown. He's been in CA 7 months, he says. He eschews the normal CA drug-a-log's macho war stories and gets right to his bottom, his jumping-off place. Joelle can tell he's trying to tell the truth, and not just posturing and performing the way so many CAs seem like they do. His story's full of colored idioms and those annoying little colored hand motions and gestures, but to Joelle it doesn't seem like she cares that much anymore. She can identify. The truth has a kind of irresistible unconscious attraction at meetings, no matter what the color or fellowship. Even denial aisle and the standing men are absorbed by the colored man's story. The colored man says his thing is he'd had a wife and a little baby daughter at home in Mattapan's Perry Hill projects, and another baby on the way. He'd managed to hang on to his menial riveter's assistant job at Universal Bleacher right up the street from here in Enfield because his addiction to crank cocaine wasn't every day. He smoked on your binge-type basis, mostly weekends. Hellacious, psychopathic, bank account emptying binges, though. Like getting strapped to a Raytheon missile, and you don't stop till that missile stops, Jim. He says his wife had got temp work cleaning houses, but when she worked, they had to put their little girl in a daycare that just about ate her day's pay. So his paycheck was like their total float. And his weekend binges with a glass pipe caused them no end of financial insecurity, which he mispronounces. Which brings him to his last binge. The bottom, which predictably occurred on a payday. This check just had to go for groceries and rent. They were 2 months back, and there was not jack shit in the house in the way of to eat. At a smoke break at Universal Bleacher, he'd made sure and bought just one single vial, for just a tensky, for a Sunday night treat after a weekend of abstinence and groceries and quality time with his pregnant wife and little daughter. The wife and little daughter were to meet him after work right off the bus stop at Brighton Best Savings, right under the big clock, to help him deposit the paycheck right then and there. He let his wife stipulate the meeting at the bank because he knew, in a self-disgusted way even then, that there was this hazard of paycheck-type incidents from binges he'd pulled in the past, and their financial insecurity was now whatever words passed the word deep shit. And he knew goddamn well he could not afford to fuck up this time. He says, that's how he used to think of it to himself. Fucking up. He didn't even make it to the bus after clocking out, he said. Two other Holmeses, in Riveting, had 3 vials each.
293.
Which vials they had, like, brandished at him. And he'd kicked in his 1 vial because 2 1/3 vials versus 1 thin-ass Sunday night vial was only a fucking fool way out of touch with the whole seize-the-opportunity concept could pass that shit up. In short, it was the familiar insanity of money in the pocket and no defense against the urge, and the thought of his woman holding his little girl in her little knit cap and mittens standing under the big clock in cold March dusk didn't so much get pushed aside as somehow shrink to a tiny locket-size picture in the center of a part of him he and the Holmeses had set out busily to kill with the pipe. He says he never made the bus. They passed a bottle of rye around the old Ford Mystique, one of the Holmeses profiled, and fired up right in the car. And after he once fired up with dollars in his pocket, the fat woman with the little helmet with horns on it done already like fucking sang, Jim.
294.
The man's hands grip the sides of the podium, and he rests his weight on his elbow-locked arms in a way that conveys both abjection and pluck. He invites the CAs to let's just draw the curtain of charity over the rest of the night scene, which after the check-cashing stop got hazy with missile exhaust anyhow. But so he finally did get home to Mattapan the next morning, Saturday morning, sick and green-yellow, and on that mean post-crank slide, dying for more and willing to kill for more, and yet so mortified and ashamed of having done fucked up again that just going up the elevator to their apartment was maybe the bravest thing he'd ever done up to that point, he felt. It was like 0600 in the AM, and they weren't there. There was nobody home, and in the sort of way where the place's emptiness pulsed and breathed. An envelope was slid under the door from the BHA.
295.
Not the salmon color of an eviction notice, but a green last warning with regards to rent. And he went into the kitchen and opened up the fridge, hating himself for hoping there was a beer. In the fridge was a jar of grape jelly, near empty, and a half a can of biscuit mix. And that, plus a sour empty fridge odor, was all, Jim. A little plastic jar of labelless food bank peanut butter so empty its insides had knife scrapes on the sides, and a little clotted box of salt was all there was in the whole rest of the kitchen. But what sent his face clear down off his skull and broke him in two, though, was he said when he saw the Pam shiny empty biscuit pan on top of the stove and the plastic rind of the peanut butter's safety seal wrap on top of the wastebasket's tall pile. The little locket picture in the back of his head swelled and became a sharp, focused scene of his wife and little girl and little unborn child eating what he now could see they must have eaten last night and this morning, while he was out ingesting their groceries and rent. This was his cliff edge, his personal intersection of choice, standing there, loose-faced in the kitchen, running his finger around a shiny pan, with not one little crumb of biscuit left in it. He sat down on the kitchen tile with his scary eyes shut tight but still seeing his little girl's face. They'd ate some charity peanut butter on biscuits, washed down with tap water, and a grimace. Their apartment was 6 floors up in Perry Hills building number 5. The window didn't open but could be broke through with a running start. He didn't kill himself, though, he says. He just got up and walked out. He didn't leave his wife a note. Not nothing. He went and walked the whole 4 clicks to Shattuck Shelter and Jamaica Plain. He felt like for sure they'd have been better off without him, he said. But he said he didn't know why, but he didn't kill himself. But he didn't. He figures there was some God involvement sitting there on the floor. He just decided to go to Shattuck and surrender and get straight and never, ever have his little girl's grimacing face in his hungover head ever again, James. And Shattuck Shelter, by coincidence, that usually had a waiting list every March until it got warm, they just kicked out some sorry-ass specimen for defecating in the shower. And they took him, the speaker. He asked for a CA meeting right away, and a Shattuck staff guy called somebody Afro-American with a lot of clean recovered time, and the speaker got taken to his first CA meeting. That was 224 days ago, tonight. That night, when the colored CA crocodile dropped him off back at the Shattuck, after he'd wept in front of other colored men at his first meeting and told men he didn't know from shit about the big clock and glass pipe and paycheck and the biscuits in his little girl's face, and after he come back to the Shattuck and got buzzed through and the buzzer sounded for supper, it turned out, by coincidence, that the Saturday night Shattuck supper was coffee and peanut butter sandwiches. It was the end of the week, and the shelter's donated food had run out. They only had PB on cheap-ass white bread and Sunny Square instant coffee, the cheap shit that doesn't even quite dissolve all the way. He's got your autodidactic orator's way with emotional dramatic pauses that don't seem affected. Joelle makes another line down the styrofoam coffee cup with her fingernail and chooses consciously to believe it isn't affected. The story's emotive drama. Her eyes feel sandy from forgetting to blink. This always happens when you don't expect it, when it's a meeting you have to drag yourself to and are all but sure will suck. The speaker's face has lost its color, shape, everything distinctive. Something has taken the tight ratchet in Joelle's belly and turned it 3 turns to the good. It's the first time she's felt sure she wants to keep straight no matter what it means facing. No matter if Don Gately takes Demerol, or goes to jail, or rejects her if she can't show him the face. It's the first time in a long time, tonight, 11:14, Joelle's even considered possibly showing somebody the face. After the pause, the speaker says all the other sorry motherfuckers in the Shattuck shelter in there started into bitching about what was this shit, peanut butter sandwiches for fucking supper. The speaker says how whatever he silently thanked for, just that particular sandwich he held and chewed, washing it down with gritty Sunny Square coffee, that thing became his higher power. He's now 7+ months clean. Universal Bleacher let him go, but he's got steady work at Logan, pushing a 3rd shift mop, and a Holmes on his cruise also in the program, by coincidence. His pregnant wife, it turned out, had gone to an unwed mother's shelter with Chantel that night. She was still in there. DSS still won't let him appeal his wife's restraining order and see Chantel. But he got to talk to his little girl on the phone just last month. And he's now straight. From giving up and joining the freeway access group and getting active and taking the voluntary suggestions of the Fellowship of Cocaine Anonymous. His wife was due to have her baby around Xmas. He said he didn't know what was going to happen to him or his family. But he says he has received certain promises from his new family, the Freeway Access Group of Cocaine Anonymous. And so he had certain hope-type emotions about the future inside. He didn't so much conclude or make obligatory reference to gratitude or any of that usual shit as grip the lectern and shrug and say he'd started feeling just last month that the choice he made on the kitchen floor was the right choice, personally speaking. Entertainment-wise, things take a rapid turn for the splattery once the tough girl Blood Sisters seem to have saved is found bluely dead in her novitiate's cot, her habit's interior pockets stuffed with all kinds of substances and paraphernalia, and her arm a veritable forest of syringes. Tight shot of B.S., face working purply, staring down at the XX punker. Suspecting foul play instead of spiritual recidivism, blood sister. Disregarding first the other cheek pieties, and then the impassioned pleas, and then the direct orders of the vice mother superior. Who happens now to be the tough nun who'd saved blood sister way back? Begins reverting to her former Toronto mean street pre-salvation, tough biker chick ways. Demufflering her Harley hog. Hauling an age-faded, stud-covered leather bike jacket out of storage and squeezing it over her pectoral swollen habit. Unbandaging her most lurid tattoos, shaking down former altar boys for information, flipping off motorists who get in her bike's way. Meeting old street contacts in dim saloons and tossing back jiggers with even the most serotic of them. Beating, bludgeoning, aikidoing, disarming thugs of power tools, avenging the desalvation and demapping of her young charge. Determined to prove that the girl's death was no accident or backslide. That blood sister had not failed with the soul she'd chosen to save, to discharge her own soul's debt to the tough old vice mother superior who'd saved her, blood sister, so far back. Several thuggish stuntmen, and countless liters of potassium thiocyanate later.
296.
The truth does out. The novitiate girl had been murdered by the mother superior. The order's top. And toughest nun. This Mother Superior is the nun who'd saved the vice Mother Superior, who'd saved Blood Sister, meaning, ironically, that the evidence Blood Sister needs to prove that her salvation debt really was discharged is also evidence inimical to the legal interests of the tough nun to whom Blood Sister's own savior is obligated. So Blood Sister gets increasingly tortured and ill-tempered as evidence of the Mother Superior's guilt accretes. In one scene, she says, "Fuck." In another, she swings a censer like a mace and brains an old verger, who's one of the Mother Superior's stooges, knocking his toothless head clean off. Then in Act 3, a veritable orgy of retribution follows the full emergence of the sordid truth. It seems that the tough old vice Mother Superior, namely the nun who'd saved Blood Sister, had in fact not been saved, truly, after all. Had in fact, during 20-plus years of exemplary novena-saying and wafer-baking, been suffering a kind of hidden degenerative recidivist soul rot, and had resumed the vice MS at about the time Blood Sister had donned the habit of full nunhood, had not only resumed substance dependence, but had started actually dealing in serious weights of whatever at the time was most profitable, which after 20-plus years had changed from Marseillaise heroin to Colombian freebaseable-grade Bing Crosby, to support her own hidden habit, covertly operating a high-volume retail operation out of the Order's Community Outreach Rescue Mission's little-used confessionals. This nun superior, the top-tough mother superior nun, stumbling on to the drug operation after the now demapped verger informed her that a suspicious number of limousines were discharging gold-chained and not very penitent-looking persons into the Order's Community Outreach Rescue Mission, and disastrously unable to summon the pious humility to accept the fact that she'd failed, it seemed, at truly and forever saving the ex-dealer, whose salvation the Mother Superior required to discharge the debt to the now-retired octogenarian nun who'd saved her, this Mother Superior herself is the one who murdered Blood Sister's ex-punk novitiate to silence the girl. What emerges is that Blood Sister's addicted punk girl substance-copping venue, when she was out there pre-salvation, had been nothing other than the Vice Mother Superior's infamous Community Outreach Rescue Mission. In other words, the nun who'd saved Blood Sister, but had herself been secretly unsaved, had been the tough girl's Bing dealer. Is why the tough non-Catholic girl'd been so mysteriously adept at the confidier. The Order's Mother Superior had figured that
It was only a matter of time before the girl's conversion and salvation reached the sort of spiritual pitch where her guarded silence broke when she told Blood Sister the seamy truth about the nun she, Blood Sister, thought had saved her, Blood Sister. So she, the Mother Superior, had eliminated the girl's map, ostensibly. She, the Mother Superior, told her lieutenant, the Vice Mother Superior, to save her, the Vice Mother Superior, from exposure and excommunication, and maybe worse if the girl weren't silenced.
297.
This narratively prolix and tangled stuff all gets explicated at near kabuki volume during an appalling free-for-all in the office of the Mother Superior, who hadn't saved the Vice MS, who'd saved Blood Sister, with the two senior nuns, who'd been tough and unsaved back in the Ontarian days when men were men and so were drug-addicted bike chicks, teaming up and kicking Blood Sister's ass. The fight scene a blur of swirling habitments and serious martial arts against the spot-lit backdrop of the wall's huge decorative mahogany crucifix, with Blood Sister giving a good account of herself but still getting her wimple beat in, and finally, after several whirling kicks to the forehead, starting to bid adieu to her corporeal map and commend herself to the arms of God, until the unsaved recidivist Vice Mother Superior nun who'd saved Blood Sister, wiping blood from her eyes after a headbutt and seeing the Mother Superior about to decapitate Blood Sister with a souvenir Champlain-era tomahawk the Huron nun who'd been saved by the original founder of the Toronto Tough Girl Saving Order, had used to decapitate Jesuit missionaries before she, the tough Huron nun, had been saved, seeing the tomahawk raised with both arms before the normally pious-eyed old Mother Superior's face, a face now rendered indescribable in aspect by the absence of humility and the passion for truth silencing that added up to pure and radical evil, seeing now the upraised hatchet and demonized face of the MS, the unsaved vice nun has a moment of epiphanic, anti-recidivist spiritual clarity, and averts Blood Sister's demapping by leaping across the office and cold-cocking the Mother Superior with a large, decorative, mahogany, Christian object, so symbolically obvious it needn't even be named. The object's symbolic unsubtlety making both Hal and Bridget Boone cringe. Now Blood Sister has the Champlain-era hatchet, and the unsaved nun who'd saved her has an unnamed object whose mahogany's no match for a hatchet. And they stand facing each other over the prone Mother Superior's puddle of skirts, chests heaving, and the Vice MS has a writhing expression under her askew wimple like, "Go ahead, make the circle of recidivist retribution against the nun you thought had saved you, but ultimately couldn't even save herself. Complete, complete the lapsarian circuit." Or whatever. They stare at each other for countless frames, the office wall behind them cruciformly pale, where the unnamed object had hung. Then Blood Sister shrugs in resignation and drops the tomahawk, and turns, and with an ironic little obeisance, walks out the Mother Superior's office door, and through the little sacristy and over the altar and down the little convent nave, bike boots echoing on the tile, emphasizing the silence, and out the big doors whose tympanum overhead is carved with a sword and a plowshare and a syringe and a soup ladle and the motto, "Contraria sunt complementa," the heaviness of which makes Hal cringe so severely it's Boone who has to supply the translation Kent Blott asks for.
298.
On screen, we're still following the tough nun, or ex-nun. The fact that the hatchet she resignedly dropped fetched the prone Mother Superior a pretty healthy knock is presented as clearly accidental, because she, Blood Sister, is still walking away from the convent, moving emphatically and in a gradually deepening focus, limping toughly eastward into the twittering Toronto dawn. The cartridge's closing sequence shows her astride her hog on Toronto's meanest street, about to lapse, backslide back into her tough, pre-saved ways? It's unclear, in a way that's supposed to be rich. Her expression is agnostic at best, but the huge sign of a discount Harley muffler outlet juts just at the horizon she's roaring toward. The closing credits are the odd lime green of bugs on a windshield. It's hard to tell whether Boone and Dash's applause is sarcastic. There's that post-entertainment flurry of changed positions and stretched limbs and critical sallies. Out of nowhere, Hal remembers Smothergill. Postlethwaite says he and the Idman brought Blot in to speak to Hal about something disturbing they encountered during their disciplinary shit detail in the tunnels that PM. Hal holds up a hand for the kids to hang on, flipping through cartridge cases to see whether low-temperature civics is up here. All the cases are clearly labeled. The apparition receded, the red of its coat shrinking against the swinging view of Prospect Street and pavement and dumpsters and looming storefronts. Ruth Van Cleve on its lurid tail and receding also, screaming bits of urban argot that became less faint than swallowed. Kate Gompert held her hurt head and heard it roar. Ruth Van Cleve's pursuit was slowed by her arms, which were waving around as she screamed, and the apparition was swinging their purses to clear a path on the sidewalk before it. Kate Gompert could see pedestrians leaping out into the street way up ahead to avoid getting clocked. The whole visual scene seemed tinged and violet. A voice under a storefront awning right nearby somewhere said, "Seen it." Kate Gompert leaned over again and held the part of her head that surrounded her eye. The eye was palpably swelling shut, and her whole vision was queerly violet. A sound in her head like a drawbridge being drawn up. Implacable trundle and squeaks. Hot, watery spit was flooding her mouth, and she kept swallowing against nausea.
"Seen it? Bet your ever-living goddamn life I seen it."
A kind of gargoyle seemed to detach itself from a storefront hardware display and moved in, its motions oddly jerky, as in a film missing frames.
"Seen the whole thing," it said.
Then repeated it.
"I'm a witness," it said.
Kate Gompert put her other arm out against the light post and hauled herself mostly upright, looking at it.
"Witness the whole goddamn thing," it said.
In the eye, that wasn't swelling shut, the thing resolved violently into a bearded man in an army coat and a sleeveless army coat over that coat, spittle in his beard. One eye had a system of exploded arteries in it. He shook like an old machine. There was a smell involved. The old man got right up close, looming in, so that pedestrians had to curve out around both of them together. Kate Gompert could feel her pulse in her eye.
"Witness! Eyewitness! The whole thing!"
But he was looking someplace else, like more around at people passing.
"Seen it. I'm him."
Not clear who he was shouting at. It wasn't her. And the passers-by were paying that studious urban kind of no attention as they broke and melted around them at the light post and then reformed. Kate Gompert had the idea that supporting herself against the light post would keep her from throwing up. Concussion is really another word for a bruised brain. She tried not to think about it, that the impact had maybe sent one part of her brain slamming against her skull, and now that part was purply swelling, mashed up against the inside of her skull. The light post she held herself up with was what had hit her.
"Fellow, I'm your fellow. Witness, saw it all."
And the old fellow was holding a trembling palm up just under Kate Gompert's face, as if he wanted it thrown up into. The palm was violet, with splotches of some sort of possible fungal decay, and with dark branching lines where the pink palm lines of people who don't live in dumpsters usually are. And Kate Gompert studied the palm abstractly, and the weather-bleached gigabucks ticket on the pavement below it.
299.
The ticket seemed to recede into a violet mist and then move back up. Pedestrians barely glanced at them and then looked studiously elsewhere. A drunk-looking pale girl and a street bum showing her something in his hand.
"When is the whole thing being committed?"
the man remarked to a passerby with a cellular on his belt. Kate Gompert couldn't summon the juice to tell him to go screw. That's the way it was said down here in the real city. "Go screw," with a deft little thumb gesture. She couldn't even say go away, though the smell involved in the man made it worse, the nausea. It seemed terribly important not to vomit. She could feel her pulse in her eye, the pole had hit.
as if the strain of vomiting could aggravate the spongy purpling of the part of her brain the pole had bruised.
The thought made her want to vomit in this horrid palm that wouldn't stay still. She tried to reason. If the man had witnessed the whole thing, then how could he think she'd have change to put in his hand? Ruth Van Cleve had been listing some of her baby's jailed father's wittier aliases when Kate Gompert had felt a hand strike her back and close around the strap of her purse. Ruth Van Cleve had cried out as the apparition of just about the most unattractive woman Kate Gompert had ever seen crashed forward between them, knocking them apart. Ruth Van Cleve's vinyl purse's strap gave right away, but Kate Gompert's thin but densely macramed strap held around her shoulder, and she was pulled wrenchingly forward by the womanly apparition's momentum as it tried to sprint up Prospect Street. And the red hag-like figure was yanked wrenchingly back as the quality filings all-cotton, French braidedly macramed purse strap held, and Kate Gompert had got a whiff of something danker than the dankest municipal sewage, and a glimpse of what looked like a 5-day facial growth on the hag's face, as street-tough Ruth Van Cleve got a grip on her, his, its red leather coat, proclaiming the thief a son of a muff-fun-ho. Kate Gompert was staggering forward, trying to get her arm out of the strap's loops. They all three moved forward together this way. The apparition spun itself violently around, trying to shake off Ruth Van Cleve, and her its spin with her purse took the strap-attached Kate Gompert, who didn't weigh very much, out, around, in a wide circle. She'd had a flashback of reminiscence back to Crack the Whip at the Wellesley Hills Skating Club's rinks, Wee Blades toddler skating hour as a child, gaining speed. And then a rust-pocked curbside lightpost rotated toward her, also gaining speed, and the sound was somewhere between a bonk and a clang, and the sky and the sidewalk switched places, and a violet sun exploded outward, and the whole street turned violet and swung like a clanging bell. And then she was alone, and purseless, and watching the two recede, both seeming to be shrieking for help. The 14th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. A disadvantage of your nasally ingested cocaine being that at a certain point somewhere past the euphoric crest, if you haven't got the sense left to stop and just ride the crest and instead keep going nasally, it takes you into regions of almost interstellar cold and nasal numbness. Randy Lentz's sinuses were frozen against his skull, numb and hung with crystal frost. His legs felt like they ended at the knees. He was trailing two very small-sized Chinese women as they lugged enormous paper shopping bags east on Bishop Allen Drive under Central. His heart sounded like a shoe in the Ennett House basement's dryer. His heart was beating that loud. The Chinese women scuttled at an amazing rate, given their size, and the bag's size. It was circa 22:12:30 to 22:12:40 hours, smack in the middle of the former interval of issues resolution. The Chinese women didn't walk so much as scuttle with a kind of insectile rapidity. And Lance was heart-pressed to both keep up and seem to casually saunter, numb from the knee down and the nostril back. They made the turn under Prospect Street, two or a few blocks below Central Square, moving in the direction of Inman Square. Lance followed 10 or 30 paces behind, eyes on the twine handles of the shopping bags. The Chinese women were about the size of fire hydrants, and moved like they had more than the normal amount of legs, conversing in their anxious and high-pitched monkey language. Evolution proved your orientoid tongues were closer to your primatal languages than not. At first, on the brick sidewalks of the stretch of Mass Ave between Harvard and Central, Lance had thought they might be following him. He'd been followed a great deal in his time. And like the well-read Jeffrey D., he knew only too well, thank you, that the most fearsome surveillance got carried out by unlikely-looking people that followed you by walking in front of you with small mirrors in their glasses' temples, or elaborate systems of cellular communicators for reporting to the command center, or else also by helicopters, also, that flew too high to see, hovering,
the tiny chop of their rotors disguised as your own drumming heart. But after he'd had success at successfully shaking the Chinese woman twice, the second time so successfully he'd had to tear ass around through alleys and vault wooden fences to pick them up again a couple blocks north on Bishop Allen Drive, scuttling along, jabbering, he'd settled down in his conviction about who was trailing who here. As in, just who had the controlling discretion over the general situation right here. The ejection from the house, which the ejection had at first seemed like the kiss of a death sentence, had turned out to maybe be just the thing. He'd tried the straight-on narrow, and for his pains had been threatened and dismissively sent off. He'd given it his best, and for the most part, impressively. And he had been sent away, alone, and at least now could openly hide. R. Lentz lived by his wits out here, deeply disguised, on the anonymous streets of North Cambridge and Somerville, never sleeping, ever moving, hiding in bright lit and public plain sight, the last place they would think to find him. Lentz wore fluorescent yellow snow pants, a slightly shiny coat to a long-tailed tux, a sombrero with little wooden balls hanging off the brim, oversized tortoiseshell glasses that darkened automatically in response to bright light, and a glossy black mustache promoted from the upper lip of a mannequin at Leechmere's in Cambridgeside. The ensemble, the result of bold snatch and sprints all up and down the nighttime Charles, when he'd first gone overground northeast from Enfield several odd days back. The absolute blackness of the mannequin's mustache, very securely attached with promoted crazy glue and made even glossier by the discharge from a nose Lentz can't feel running, gives his pallor an almost ghostly aspect in the sombrero's portable shade. Another both advantage and disadvantage of nasal cocaine is that eating becomes ociose and optional, and one forgets to, for extended periods of time, to eat. In his gaudy pastiche of disguise, he passes easily for one of Metro Boston's homeless and wandering mad, the walking dead and dying, and is given a wide berth by all comers. The trick, he's found, is to not sleep or eat, to stay up and moving at all times, alert in all six directions at all times, heading for under the cover of tea station or enclosed mall whenever the invisible rotor's cardiac chop betrayed surveillance at altitude.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.